morning, everybody. This is the special Safety and Security meeting, committee meeting of September 3, 2015. The, Mr. Chairman, do we need to do something to approve of the last meeting that was in executive section? Executive session? Okay. So as is the custom at our meetings, we will begin with a safety message from our Chief Safety Officer, Mr. Dougherty.
First, we'd like to note that in the event of a building alarm, we have a very easy exit. To my left over here, the exit sign, which will need to keep that aisleway cleared. You can cross, exit the building right there, cross at F and Fifth Street, and then convene or meet in front of the National Building Museum so that we can ensure that we have everyone. Our safety contact today deals with the schools and colleges back in session. And there's a poster that's actually out on how to not get hit by a car that's put out by Safe Kids. And I'd like to just review, you know, some of the things that you might want to remind any students that you have and your family, that it's just a good reminder to be safe, to never walk while texting or talking on the phone. If texting, move out of the way of others and stop on the sidewalk. Never cross the street while using an electronic device. Do not walk with headphones on. Be aware of your surroundings. Always walk on the sidewalk if one is available. If a child must walk on the street, he or she should face oncoming traffic. Look left, right, then left again, crossing the street, and only cross at crosswalks. And just some of the statistics, 1 in 5 high school students cross the street while distracted. Crossing someplace other than an intersection accounts for 81% of child pedestrian deaths. 75% of teen pedestrian deaths occur between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. when it's dark. More than 1 in 5 pedestrian deaths happen in an intersection. Sidewalks can reduce pedestrian crashes by almost 90%. Nearly 100 kids are killed by cars backing up each year. And last, more than 80% of pedestrians die when hit by vehicles traveling at 40 miles an hour or faster, and less than 10% when hit at 20 miles per hour or less. That concludes our safety contact, Mr. Goldman.
A few preliminary motions. We need approval of today's agenda for this special meeting. I'll entertain a motion. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Carries. The agenda for today's special meeting is adopted. Second issue is approval of the minutes from our last regular scheduled meeting, which was on July 23rd, 2015, and with the acting assistant administrator from the Federal Transit Administration, Ms. McMillan, addressed us. So I'll entertain a motion for approval of the minutes from that July 23rd meeting.
So moved.
Second? Okay. Adopted. Thank you. Now we've taken care of the administrative business, I'd like to provide a brief overview of the meeting before turning the floor over to Mr. Troop and Mr. Dougherty. Following the derailment of the train on Thursday, August 6th, staff conducted an investigation into the root causes and contributing factors that led to the derailment. The preliminary investigation was released publicly at the end of last week. And Mr. Troop and Mr. Dougherty will walk us through their findings as well as provide an overview of the process changes that have been implemented by management since that incident. Mr. Dougherty will also provide us with a timeline on his investigation of the incident as Chief Safety Officer and the report that he is preparing for the TOC, the Tri-State Oversight Commission. Following the presentation and questions from board members, we'll have a short discussion of the concept of next steps on behalf of the committee, and one of those would be a kind of sense of the board resolution that we'll discuss without actually moving or voting on a particular language at this time. It essentially would be an opportunity to discuss the need for such a resolution and follow-up actions and what it would consist of. Mr. Troop.
The safety concerns and quickly provide information to the board, our riders, our stakeholders, and our local jurisdictions. WMATA is conducting the investigation, as you had mentioned, in two parts and has released information as it has become available. First Rail, under Mr. Troop, has completed its operational inspection, which is a standard practice for any major incident in the Metro Rail system. This report was released last Friday, and Mr. Troop will walk us through the findings this morning. The report identifies immediate safety actions that he has taken that are being implemented now and as the full investigation continues. The full investigation is being conducted jointly by the Tri-State Oversight Committee and the Metro Safety Department. And Mr. Doherty will report on the status of that report. Before I turn it over, as I turn it over to Mr. Troop, the first thing we're asking him to do this morning, he wants to make a personnel announcement, and then we'll go into the report, and at this time I'll turn it over to Rob.
Thank you, Jack, and I do appreciate the opportunity to speak on the incident and our actions moving forward. As Jack indicated, I would like to make a personnel announcement. I'm pleased to announce that we have made a permanent selection for the Assistant General Manager of Transit Infrastructure and Engineering Services, which is a critical position, both in answering any questions here and also the FTA SMI moving forward with the capital rebuilding program. Prior to making that announcement, though, I would like to thank Randy Grumman, who's in the back. Randy took on the acting role. He's a 35-year veteran of WMATA. He's currently our managing director of plant maintenance. He will be going back to that role. His experience, his leadership has been valuable to us during this period of time. And again, thank you very much, Randy, for taking this position, taking it seriously in very difficult times. And I would also like to announce, I'm pleased to announce Mr. Andy Off, who will assume the roles of the Assistant General Manager of Transit Infrastructure and Engineering Services September 6th, and there will be a transition period, and he will fully assume those duties on September 11th. As background, Andy has over 20 years of leadership and management experience while serving in engineering and operational roles as a uniformed officer in the United States Army Corps of Engineers. During his time, he served in project management, construction management, and leadership roles. And for the past 4 years, Mr. Off has served as the assistant chief engineer for TRAC and also as the director of infrastructure renewal project management. Andy holds a Bachelor of Science degree in civil engineering from the United States Military Academy at West Point. He holds a Master of Science degree in civil engineering from Georgia Tech. He holds a Master of Science degree in engineering management from the University of Missouri. And he also holds a graduate certificate in railroad engineering from the University of Delaware. He's a registered professional engineer in the state of Virginia and a certified project management professional. He holds a federal government contracting officer warrant for the administration of construction contracts. Andy was deployed for a year in support of Operation Enduring Freedom, and he continues to serve as a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserves in the Corps of Engineers. He's a member of the American Railway Engineering and Maintenance of Way Association, and he's an active member of Team 41 Track Maintenance. I know, again, his leadership skills and his technical expertise will be invaluable to us now and also in the many years to come. So, again, thank you, Andy. I appreciate you taking this role.
Mr. Chair, before you go into the operations report, could you describe what the gentleman's responsibilities will be with WMATA?
Yes, I will. So the Assistant General Manager, Track Infrastructure and Engineering Services, has responsibility for all maintenance, engineering, along for the railroad and facilities in WMATA. This includes both the infrastructure right-of-way and also the engineering facilities for bus maintenance facilities. He also is responsible for facilitation of the capital program, in addition to being directly responsible for over $600 million of execution on those specific projects. So again, it's a wide-ranging role. It has about 4,500 employees reporting to it, but again, it's all both the maintenance operations and engineering and the capital program for the authority. Mm-hmm. Okay, his background, a six-car train derailed while performing a drill move after making an employee service stop at Federal Triangle. The train was inbound on two track, where it then reversed ends to make a 2-to-1 outbound move at Smithsonian to be put into regular passenger service. The train derailed on the inbound side of the interlocking, where the lead axle of the last truck on the third car came off the rail. Subsequently, axles on the fourth, fifth, and sixth cars also left the rail. The two lead cars were in the process of making the crossover move and were stopped, failing both two and one track. And I do want to be very clear, the car did not derail over the crossover. But this did cause significant delays to passengers and required extensive work to rerail the train and to also make the track repairs. Our crews worked through the night and service restored fully prior to evening rush the next day. Engineering operations and safety staff are currently engaged in an ongoing investigation into the root cause of the accident. The process for the investigation, as the general manager indicated, is to create an early DGMO incident report where the data is collected and determinations are made to any specific systemic or unsafe condition which may exist, and necessary immediate action is required to eliminate or mitigate the discovered risk. It needs to be clearly noted that this is only a piece of an overall investigatory process, with the final report being constructed by the Safety Department and the Tri-State Oversight Committee. Other action items are expected to come as a result of the final report. In this instance, the early finding is that the derailment was caused by broken fasteners, which was made worse due to a wide gauge issue near the point of derailment. Subsequent investigation and track inspection reports revealed that the track geometry vehicle, or TGV, noted the wide gauge condition during a July 9th run. However, the wide gauge was erroneously deleted by the technician who is responsible for interpreting the data and providing an exception report to maintenance crews at the end of the run. As a point of information, the TGV uses optical readers and ultrasonic equipment to perform a multitude of track inspections. There are basically two working running modes for the unit, geometry testing and a combination of geometry and ultrasonic testing. When the unit is doing only geometry testing, it runs at speeds of up to 35 miles per hour and is checking for gauge, railhead profile, twist, warp, and rail elevation, among some other things. The ultrasonic testing performs geometry testing, as previously explained, and also checks for internal defects within the rail, providing valuable information that lets us get ahead of potential rail breaks. As the TGV makes its run, the data shown on the screen is a series of strip charts in specific swim lanes dependent on the data that is being collected. As an explanation of both the process and how that process failed, I'm going to go to the whiteboard to illustrate the mechanism for collecting and analyzing the data. So again, I'll speak loud so it'll pick it up. So again, there's a technician that is sitting at a screen. The technician is sitting at the screen and he's watching the data go by. Now, if we imagine that this is the track, this is two track and one track, and this is a crossover. The technician is sitting there. The machine's running anywhere between 15 and 35 miles an hour to be able to check the data. There's a number of these swim lanes that it's checking for, looking for things like wide gauge, warp, twist, these types of things. So let's just look at the geometry, the wide gauge, which is the one that we're interested in.
It showed those parts.
I don't have a slide that has that. What we'll do then is, again, this is running on the computer screen, and the information, the gauge is not perfectly, it's not perfect, so there is some little variations that the unit will see as it goes on. So the unit is checking. If it gets to a wide gauge issue, it'll do this. Now, because of the optical couplers, when it gets to a switch point, the data goes like this. When it gets to a frog, the data will do that. When it gets to another switch point.
Frog? I'm sorry. Definition?
Oh, frog. I'm sorry. A frog is the point where two tracks cross together. So there's the switch points, and then it's the piece of steel that looks like a frog that's displayed out. So then it gets to another switch point, and it does this. And then it moves forward. And if it gets to a wide gauge issue, it'll look like this. And then maybe another wide gauge issue, and it looks like this. So that's kind of what it looks. Now, even something like a potato chip bag that's on the right-of-way, because it's an optical coupler, a potato chip bag on the right-of-way can cause a spike in the information. Now, what the TGV operator is trained to do, he's trained to recognize that rail doesn't bend like this. You understand that, you know, rail can't bend like this, so he's given training to be able to interpret that data. What you have is a limit that the machine has for exceptions. So there's a limit that we have that's loaded into the machine that says what the exception is for wide gauge as he's moving through. So that's defined here. So that's defined here as the line, and we also have a line for tight gauge. So there's limits which are defined for each of these, but again, it requires a certain amount of data interpretation because of the way that the data is collected. It requires a human to be able to look at the data and request it. So as the machine goes through and this exception report is worked, what will happen is he'll see this and say, okay, that's obviously not an exception, and that information will be deleted. Again, that information will be deleted. What happened was he erroneously deleted one of these pieces of information. The wide gauge information was deleted from the unit. Now, what needs to be recognized is that there were actually four level black instances in this particular run. He did not delete. He just deleted the one. There were three others which were taken care of. So that's how the process works. Again, and that's what happened there. He erroneously deleted that data. So, the technician is trained by a WMATA personnel who had been trained by ENSCO, who's the electronics manufacturer. Again, we recognize the human element in this failure, and we certainly don't excuse it. But we also recognize that it is imperative that we understand and appreciate that human error can and does occur, and we must have the processes in place that safeguard against these types of misjudgments. So moving forward, we're currently focused on the following actions. We began detailed inspections of fasteners, and where necessary, we initiated the replacement of older style fasteners in the system on the outer rail and all curves with a radius less than 1,425 feet. What the TGV has shown us, and we've recognized this, is that most of our gauge issues are within curve areas. That's where we have most of the stresses on the system is within the curved areas, particularly in the tight radius curves. Again, we're doing this out of abundance of caution so that we can baseline what we're seeing and what we're taking care of. We've conducted inspections on 41 of our curves that have a radius tighter than 800 feet. 26 of these curves are progressing repairs. All of them are in service. 26 of them do have some level of speed restriction on it, but we are progressing repairs on those. Currently, we do have the TGV running through the entire system, again, as baselining the system. It has a chase crew. Normally, just during the ultrasonic testing, the chase crew goes. The ultrasonic testing is where they look for internal defects. The machine is running at 15 miles an hour, so the prime mover, which has the crew and materials on it to be able to replace a section of rail, is able to keep up with the unit. So if they should find an internal defect, that is corrected right away. The rail is replaced right away. That's a normal course of business. In this specific one, we're also doing a chase vehicle where we're simply doing geometry testing. And again, that's the same thing. It has a prime mover, which has the fasteners, spikes, clamps, different things on it that they can affect rail repairs right away. We're about three-fifths through the system to date, and we have identified approximately 20 level black issues, which have all been taken care of. I want to be understand that's not unusual in a run to be able to discover that many level black. And what's important to understand, level black does not mean it's a precipice. It does not mean that, you know, the minute you reach level black that the train is going to derail. For example, our gauge measurements, and Andy, it's 57 and three-quarters inch. It gets 57 and three-quarter inch gets to a level black. But generally, a train needs 60 inches of gauge, wide gauge, to be able to drop into the middle. So what the level black is telling us, it's like a red line on a tachometer. You know, you can push the car to the red line. If you keep it there then it's eventually going to damage the engine. So you need to back off of that. And that's what we're saying, is if we have a level black, you know, that if we continue to operate under that circumstance, it's something that, you know, we want to be able to take care of right away. So and that needs to be understood. Again, it does not mean that we leave a level black condition out there. We take care of it, or we take the track out of service on that. In regards to the improved processes, which is most important here, the onboard functions now include a thorough review of the test results with an area manager. The area manager is responsible for the track maintenance within that specific line section that the TGV is running through. So we have a number of area managers. So at the end of run, the technician will sit down with the area manager, and they go through the exception report. Now, what's interesting is the raw data is never deleted. It's only the exception report data that is deleted. The raw data is never deleted. So what will happen is the technician and the area manager will go down. They will review the raw. They will review the data, the exception report that the technician has looked at against the raw data. So they will look at that as a verification that we did not have an instance where this occurred. Okay, so it's a cross check between those two people. So we have the primary check was the technician. The secondary check is the area manager and the technician sitting down together, going over the data, making sure that there was nothing that was deleted that shouldn't have been deleted. So and then we have a tertiary check, where this information, the raw data and the exception report, is downloaded, it's provided to track engineering, to our QAAW group, and SAFE, who then do look at the data, and within 2 days we'll be able to analyze that data and make sure that nothing's happened. So we have a tertiary check on that as well. In addition, the TGV crew now has authority to remove the track from service should repairs not be affected prior to revenue service. Again, at the end of the run, the inspections report and the raw data is provided to engineering and SAFE, like I said. We had a safety stand down. After any kind of these incidents, we always have safety stand downs to talk to the employees to understand what their challenges are, to understand what our expectations of them are, to be able to talk about the incident, to be able to review these, you know, what our findings are, where we are moving forward on this. It's very important to be able to give the employees opportunity to be able to express concerns and for us to express back to whatever those concerns we may have in regards to performance to be able to, so that we can continue to get better. We are contracting with a third party, an expert in the field of derailment, to make sure that our assumptions are correct and that our and what our conclusions are correct on this. We're going to continue our engineering analysis of unintended consequences of our standard 56 and a quarter inch gauge, our super elevation design speeds, which are greater than attainable speed, and maybe other contributory design issues on that. Standard railroads have a 56 and a half inch gauge. In fact, all our track work, all our special track work, switches, frogs, is set at a 56 and a half inch gauge. Because it's the standard. For us to require that would be significantly expensive. So what we're looking at is, if having a 56 and a quarter inch gauge, again, may put, I'm not suggesting it is, but may put undue stresses or on the rail. It's not unsafe as it is, but what it does is it creates a situation where perhaps the rail or the track bed or the track structure is wearing at a greater rate than perhaps it should. In and of itself is not a safety issue, but again, what we want to try to do is get to the root cause. What is causing these issues in our curves? What is causing these types of fastener issues moving forward? So it's important for us to be able to look at those types of things. The super elevation. Our curves have elevation in them, similar to like a NASCAR track, if you can imagine, where it's curved like this. So one rail is higher than the other. And what this does is it balances the curve at speed. So our trains are balanced at speed. In other words, all the vertical forces are balanced against the rail. Now, most of our curves, particularly not interior, but many of our curves exteriorly are designed at 75 miles an hour, which we no longer do. And many of our curves on the interior are designed at 50 miles an hour. What happens if your attainable speed is not that much. In other words, if it's between the stations and it's 50 miles an hour and the attainable speed is only 35, what happens is that train ends up crabbing. It ends up crabbing through the turn. Again, this is not a specific safety issue. I don't want to give that, but what it does, it creates a situation where you're putting higher stresses on the face, on you're creating greater rail wear, and also where you're putting greater forces on the fasteners, which would not be there otherwise. In many of the ballasted sections, or at least one or two of the ballasted sections, we have cut the super elevation down. We have cut the super elevation down, and we have noticed that we have been able to decrease the amount of rail wear that we have on that. So that's very important moving forward on these, particularly as we start to run more and more cars. It's not a linear degradation. It's not quite exponential, but it's not a linear degradation. The more cars you run, the worse it gets. So again, that requires our maintenance forces to be out there, perhaps more than to have to be out there more. And again, if we can do something to reduce that, then we reduce these issues, potential of these issues for wide gauge. So that's something that we've been looking at. It is something that we have done on the ballasted sections. It's a lot more difficult in the direct fixation sections because it requires cutting of concrete, shaving of concrete on those, so it is much more difficult. But that's one of the issues that we're looking at too. Again, trying to reduce the potential for these wide gauge issues, for having to go out there more, to be able to pay attention to those things. So we are looking at that. We also are investigating, we have been doing this, but is the programmed algorithm for defect confirmation and automatic work order loading. In other words, have the machine do this. It could almost be like if the technician goes to delete it, the machine says, wait a minute, are you sure you want to do this? I don't think that this is the machine says, I think this is a true defect. You know, it requests that information of them for that algorithm. Also being able to load that into our Optrans system. Our Optrans system is a data asset collection system, which we can use to analyze data, to be able to prioritize locations, identify those curve locations where we're getting greater rail wear, to be able to take care of things and to be able to look at these. So these are the early action items that we have moving forward. Again, yes, this was a human error. This was a human error, and I don't excuse that human error. But more importantly, we need to make sure that we have the processes and procedures in place that protect against those types of human error. Again, I want to thank, and I really do appreciate the opportunity to speak to the board and the public about this. And I turn it over now to our Chief Safety Officer, Jim Daugherty, who will provide further explanation into the process moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Troop. And good morning again, Chairman Goldman and members of the board. Just as an update on where we are at in our investigation, which is, certainly going a bit deeper into the investigation, we are working with the Tri-State Oversight Committee. We did actually even have an incident investigation committee meeting late yesterday afternoon to check in with the status. We will continue to meet and review information going forward. But at this point, we've been reviewing the operations report, verifying the information in that report, and the operations incident report, as well as any notable observations, will become part of the safety report, which is the WMATA official report for the incident investigation. We're going to be examining the human factors, the policy, and we've started that too, just so you know, that's nothing that we're waiting on. We started that from the event. Looking at policies and procedures that are currently in place, the training that's in place, maintenance protocols, and then an extensive review of the records. We've been conducting interviews, requested several documents, of which we've received many documents, including plans and training manuals, but then we have to go through these documents that we do have. We're looking at our submission, the talk from the derailment around October 4th. We did request a 30-day extension of the, from the talk for that, and I've been verbally told that that will be approved, but the talk is working with us and alongside of us going forward, so they are aware of the activities that are going on. And just a bit on the process, once the report is submitted to the TOC, there will be a 10 business day review, typically by the TOC program standard, and then the TOC may approve the report or request changes. And then once approved, then WMATA would adopt the report, and then it also, it becomes the TOC's report is required under the federal rules for, under 49 CFR 659 for an accident investigation. So we do know that there will be some time. A lot of times there is some back and forth discussion that one group or the other would like to see added. On that committee, it not only are the TOC members and the WMATA safe folks, we have the Transit Police with the Office of Emergency Management, the AGM TIES, Track and Infrastructures Group, car maintenance cars, and engineering, as well as rail transportation. So it's a pretty broad group. And, you know, as we move forward, we'll do track inspections, go back, look at what's been done, and it's an ongoing process that we're working on, and we'll get done certainly as soon as possible. However, I do want to point out, if there are anything that is identified, you know, we're not waiting until the report's done, and also we're in communications with Mr. Troop and his team to advise them of anything that would be found. And he's actually been sitting on the committee meetings also.
Mr. Dougherty, in that TOC process, when do you expect the board to get a copy of that TOC report?
Normally it's once the TOC approves and accepts that report.
And after October 4th?
Potentially, yes. And we can talk about if we're, since they're hand in hand with us at this point, maybe that process, working with the TOC chair, Mr. Smith, maybe we can, you know, possibly advance that if we can get the information, get everything drafted and available.
And when would the public be able to see that report?
Once it's approved by the TOC.
Once it's approved by the TOC, so the TOC reports become public documents at that point.
The final reports do, yes, sir.
So you would target that somewhere around the middle of October at the latest? Is that a fair projection?
Unless something in particular came up or we're waiting for any analysis to come back.
Thank you. I'm sure many members have questions. I'm going to start a question for Mr. Troop, and then we'll go around the room and have questions that way. Mr. Troop, I just want to focus first on your whiteboard example there. As I understood your presentation, the three sort of mountain peaks would be exceptions. Those would be items that would properly be deleted by the TGV operator from his exceptions report. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Now, the three curves, as I look at the three curves, I'm trying to understand which is the one that, or maybe more than one, that should not have been deleted from the exceptions report. Can you just identify the one or more than one that should not have been, that showed an out-of-gauge, a wide-gauge condition?
That's not specific to this incident. I'm just using that as an example, but I will show you what the wide gauge condition looked like.
So it would have been a rounded curve that was above that dotted line. And he's trained, I believe you said, to be able to distinguish the sort of the peaks from the wide gauge
just
above the line. And could you just discuss how is that training
in other words he did not misinterpret the data. It wasn't as if he had looked at that and said, okay, that is not a true defect. We think it was just a misstep with the button.
So by analogy, what you're saying is that so he pressed delete on an email before he read it.
Yeah. Early indications are that's the case.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up, Mr. Price?
Did that actually occur, as you indicated, that he accidentally deleted it?
Does
not the computer-generated program indicate that was a problem?
The raw data does. The computer itself does not. The computer itself does not cross-verify. That information, the raw data is never deleted, so it generates the exceptions report, which is again through all this. Otherwise, you know, all these other things would show as the exception, and that's why we said, okay, we need to verify the produced exceptions report against the end of the run, against the raw data with another set of eyes, And that's why we've created that process to be able to do that. That's what we're talking about as far as the algorithm that we're talking about developing that would be able to identify more clearly those kind of parameters.
So there's no redundancy to avoid human error in terms of, as you indicated, he hit it accidentally. What provisions do we have to offset that aspect of it through Wi-Fi? Do you not send it? Does the report go, is it not generated to a central location or something of that nature where you don't have to wait for 30 or 40 days something occurred?
Two things there. Thank you. So the first is that at the end of the run, the data, at the very end of the run, that data, the raw data in the exception report, are looked at both by the technician and the area manager. They will go through line by line. They will see, like, they'll see one of those peaks like that, and they'll say, okay, should that have, should that have been deleted? Yes, it is. Okay, we have one here. Should that, you're not showing that. We need to be able to include that. In addition, then, that information is the raw data in the exception report is now given to track engineering and also our QAAW group and our safety group. Our track engineering group will be responsible for looking at data within 2 days to be able to say, is there any nonconformance between the two of them?
Let me just one more. You said that they sit down and review the raw data and so forth. Why was it not picked up at that particular point in time when he was seated with someone else?
That process was not in place during that time.
It was not in place.
Let me clarify. So before, what would happen is the technician would just, he would generate that exception report, and that would be handed over to maintenance. So we did not have that process to be able to check that. This is the new process that we have moving forward.
Just one last question. I don't mean to monopolize the time here. How many derailments have we had in the past 4 to 5 years? And the follow-up to that, how does that compare with our peer group?
I think we've had, on the main line, we've had four derailments. It's about the same with our peer group. We had a heat buckle, which as a result of the weather, we had a heat buckle on that. We had a derailment where we had a switch that was misproperly aligned manually, and the train was, the technician on the ground said it was safe to move. And then we had the derailment at Brooklyn, where we had, it was actually a wheel climb where the rail wheel interface was a problem because of the stiffness of the truck. It wasn't a track issue. It was actually an equipment issue. We had a out of service car that was sitting on what we call a dummy truck, and that was actually where the car caused the derailment on that. So I think it's similar to what our peer group is on these, but I know I'm not telling the board members anything here. One is very concerning to us, particularly one of this nature, so we want to treat it, with a high degree. Again, those investigations, there's no commonality within those investigations as far as the cause.
Thank you. Okay, we'll resume the regular. We're going to go around the room, just regular process now. Mr. Price always sometimes wants to go out of order, but we'll resume the normal sequence. Yes, I understand. Ms. Harley.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Troop, for your report. I have several questions, but the first one I wanted to ask was actually just raised by your statement regarding the technician behavior. Can you explain the average speed that this vehicle is going checking these tracks? And is the exceptions, the potentials that are popping up, I'm assuming on the screen, the rapidity of them, is it so quick that it doesn't allow for a technician to really evaluate what he's seeing? Or is it, just I have to get these out so the report can continue unabated during this section?
Yeah, and so to answer that question, there's actually two answers to that question. The ultrasonic testing, which is looking internally into the rail, like an MRI would do, that runs at no more than 15 miles an hour. So that runs very slowly. and that's looking for the internal defects. The geometry testing, which is not looking at the internal defects, but just checking the geometry of the rail gauge profile, the rail profile itself, rail elevations, that can run anywhere between basically 20 and 35 miles an hour. To answer your question, the rapidity of the data is not so much that, like, he's sitting there, you know, that the technician would be sitting there doing this. It is manageable from that perspective, from how the data pops out, to be able to look at it, make determinations, and then to be able to delete it or not.
Okay. And my second question is, if the early indications were that the fasteners potentially may have caused this problem, can you explain why or inform as to whether or not if it is a fastener issue, why it's preferable to not replace all the fasteners and just the fasteners on curves?
A couple reasons. Curves, you have greater stresses, as I pointed out. So your straight and tangent track, there's not as much lateral load. Most of the load is vertical. So if all you have is straight vertical loading, you actually wouldn't need fasteners. But we don't, obviously. We have lateral loading, too, which is pushing out this way. So on a curve, the lateral loading is much greater than on straight and tangent track. Again, and this gets into prioritization, where when we run the TGV and we look at the data, what we're seeing is larger or more incidence of wide gauge, it'd be a yellow or, you know, a red defect on that in our curves, and particularly our tight radius curves. Again, because the lateral loading on that is more significant than on the straight and tangent track. So it's important, obviously, to replace fasteners that become defective. And also the fasteners on the straight and tangent track aren't worn as great. I mean, they don't become as defective as fasteners on here. It's interesting to note that actually on this curve, we were actually in the process of rebuilding this curve. We had done the low rail on this curve, and so we were in the process of redoing that specific curve. I mean, does that answer your question?
Yes. Okay. Is this before this new process had been integrated? In the old process, can you explain what potentially the train walker would have seen checking this area, receiving a report where exceptions had been deleted?
And our track walker inspections are something that the safety is going to be looking at very specifically. Our processes, our training, what we're requiring of them, what we're not requiring of them. Is there anything that we have to do? The track walkers themselves, one of the issues, again, the lateral loading. A track walker cannot provide lateral loading. So a track walker might actually be able to, in this specific instance, a track walker might be able to put a gauge down, and it would be within tolerance, okay, which is why the TGV is so important and our lateral load testing is so important, because what happens is, if you think of it as a sponge, if you put weight on the top of the sponge, it spreads out. So the reality is as the rail car moves down, there's lateral loading which can spread the rail. That's why the TGV, and that's why you have a third-party contractor come in that does lateral load testing. What our track inspectors are trained to do is you recognize signs of lateral loading. You look for marks on the rail. You look for movement on the rail. You look for where the rail is in relation to the fasteners. You look for different signs that there might be lateral load gauge conditions, and if they can, they also try to look at it from the standpoint of the train going by, because it also shows whether the track is pumping, doing vertical, or whether there's lateral loading on that. So, again, this is a lot of what we're looking into. Again, we talked about the robustness of our track inspections. It's not just what we were, you know, we're requiring them to report out from a defect, but what we're saying is, okay, also what are your findings? We need to look at our track walkers and say, okay, maybe you need to also report out more of what your findings, and that's part of what we're investigating now, and part of the robustness of our track walkers establishing that.
I appreciate that. I am encouraged to see that more human redundancy is being built in to review potential human errors. I will say that my major concern is that it took this incident to evaluate that there was a gap in review. And it concerns me because there are so many areas where humans work in Metro. So I am concerned that there are other processes that are currently underway where a review that is redundant is not occurring, and it fills me with pause. But I appreciate you stating your steps that you will be taking to make sure that this process has more eyes on it than one.
Ms. Harley, thank you, and I really appreciate that comment because, you know, currently reading a book, Managing the Unexpected, High Reliability Organizations, carriers, nuclear teams, and one of the things that they do well is being able to identify where those gaps are. So as a result of this, you know, an incident brings clarity, and what the book talks about is, you know, an incident is a brutal audit. You know, basically you come in, it becomes a brutal audit. There's where you find out, you know, what's going on. Incident brings clarity. So what I asked for, what I've asked staff in concert with safety to do, is to go through, first identify all those human processes, all those instances where we think there might be, you know, an issue where, you know, a safety critical item is. Identify those safety critical items that we have out there, any kind of inspections that we have, ventilation fans, switch inspections, you know, ATC work that we do, training, these types of things that create, you know, are safety critical to our operations, and then saying, where are the gaps? So we're undergoing that process as well, and we expected that to be more fully developed from the safety report. But I've asked our engineering group to do that. So actually, that's one of the first tasks that Andy's been charged with. So I really appreciate that sentiment.
Thank you. Mr. Augustine.
Well, thank you for the information. Just to follow up, obviously, a lot of the questions that Katara asked were ones that I had. I am, though, curious to know the role of safety, the safety department in this process, and its review prior to this situation of procedures that did have this lack of human redundancy, and what safety's role, presumed role prior and now, was in that process.
In our regard, so
it's really not from you.
Okay.
Because you are on the operations side, and so you have a job to do and understanding for me that I also know that there are certain blinders that you would have, and that's why we have a safety department. So it really is, I am interested to hear from safety.
Okay, actually, the safety's role is pretty much more of an oversight role, to where we don't certainly look at all of the SOPs. We see all the policy and instructions, which are high level, signed by the general manager. We look at the site-specific work plans when there's a work project, you know, that's being initiated. We look at the what we call EMIs, or engineering modifications, when a mod is being done to a project. Whenever, basically our role is more whenever, at this point, we safety certify, which is to verify for major rolling stock buses and trains, like we safety certify the trains, which is a verification that the manufacturers and then engineers have touched all the bases in those kind of procurement activities. When we have shutdowns, we have safety officers that look to make sure that safety procedures are followed, and which is everything from the proper personal protective equipment with the development of the Roadway Worker Protection Program, which came to being, unfortunately, after there were some worker fatalities back in 2010, that there was a Roadway Worker Protection Program put in place. We verify that we're following our own rules and procedures for those kind of things. We participate in the safety committees to promote safety awareness. When there's an incident, WMATA has an accident incident policy, and we conduct the investigation of major incidents that occur, be it bus, be it rail, significant fires, things along that line. And for that, we actually, for the promotion of safety awareness, the various different safety committees, and but we don't get into the detail of reviewing departmental standard operating procedures or things along that line, or even where now, than that was before. Now we're getting involved in reviewing training manuals going forward. Before it was a review process versus an approval process, if you will, as well as other different plans that are at a higher level for major projects. And because the departmental SOPs, just talking with our team, there's probably 1,000 or more throughout the agency for standard operating procedures. And to this point, we haven't looked at all those various different procedures. We do track incidents, we track near misses, and we report that data out to the executive staff as well as at the levels of the local safety committees to work with those, with the operations folks, to make improvements to drive our statistics down to our goal of zero accidents and incidents. And in a nutshell, that's there's certainly a lot more in the details to how we get to that point, but the safety department we don't go out and do physical track inspections and things along that line.
Did you have a comment?
No, Mr. Eisenstein, I think as a result of this incident and trying to be responsive to your question is that we're looking at the role of redundancy in processes and procedures is to ensure that we've thought of everything that we need to do to ensure that there are checks and balances, and that is either we're looking at that role within the rail organization as well as within the safety organization, and certainly this process is going to lead to some changes in how we manage those processes and do quality checks, not only on what the procedures are, what the policies are, but also the work that's being accomplished.
I appreciate that. So that's going to then be reviewed, and I'm pretty sure we would follow up on that, absolutely. My only one other quick one, really quickly. On the fasteners themselves, was there anything visually that the track walkers could have seen, since that was the second and that was the actual failure, that they could have seen and that they missed?
Again, that's what we're looking at. You know, the assumption is it's because there were some broken fasteners out there, some issues that were out there, there were instances where they could have seen it to be able to detect these anomalies, to understand what they were. And again, and it's important to not just, you know, the redundancy check of not just what is he finding as a defect, but what are they finding, period, so that data can also be analyzed by somebody besides the track walker themselves. In other words, if he doesn't notice there's a defect, but the reports instant, you know, say, okay, not just write your defect down, but also what you looked at, what you found, to be able to make those observations is critical moving forward on that.
Thank you. We'll skip Mr. Price this round, come back to him. Mr. Goning.
I think you've been covering the ground that I wanted to cover, with the following exception, just to make sure. You gave us, I think, a very cogent explanation of what the TGV was supposed to find, the nature of that error, that human error, the accidental delete. What's not so clear is whether or not you believe track walkers who repeatedly walk the track should have been able to find an issue with the fasteners that they did not detect. Can you clarify that?
I certainly can. And I think, you know, as we go through the report, I believe that there's the possibility that they should have been able to find something, should have been able to report on that. But more importantly to that is, what are we requiring of them? That's more importantly. What are we requiring of them as far as the track inspections? What are we looking at? What is our level of expectation? And was that level of expectation lowered so that we could be able to take that data, our track engineers, our operations, our area managers, be able to look at those reports and be able to say, this is it. Again, it's just a defect report that we're put on. You know, it's difficult for me to say, because after a derailment, it's a mess. You know, the fasteners get busted off, and it's difficult really to make a true assessment of what's going on. So that specifically I don't know, but what I do know is that the quality of our track inspections, has to improve. It's not a quality of our track inspector. Okay, it's not the quality of our track inspector. We do a good job training our track inspectors. We got to do a good job of being able to identify what they should be able to look at, the quality of the track inspector. It's the quality of the track inspection. What are we requiring of them? What are we requiring of them to report? Particularly, again, there's a fluidity in the railroad. The more that you run, the more you have to, the more detail you have to look at. So that's very important, that these types of things, to be able to look at that.
Okay, I understand that, and I also understand there's a continuum. There's a point at which things are happening with metal fatigue and with other things that are not visible to the human eye, and then a point at which it becomes visible and you want to detect it as early as possible. Are there any other remote sensing possibilities, video or sensors that we might be able to put in place to aid our track walkers, our safety inspectors? I know that for a lot of other types of applications in transportation, we're starting to use remote sensing devices. I'll throw that out there, and maybe that's not a short-term fix, but maybe that's something that could supplement what we're doing. And I'm going to then let things go, but I hope we will have a moment to get back to an incident that happened earlier this week that didn't involve mechanical safety per se, but it involved passenger safety, passenger safety incident on board a train.
Let me talk a minute about the remote monitoring, and I need to, Andy, do we still have for the heat sensors on that? Okay, so there's a couple things. Because of the heat buckle that we had as a result of at the West Hyattsville derailment, we put heat sensors, remote monitoring heat sensors on identified areas where the potential for heat buckling is greater, and those are areas where you're coming from a ballasted section into a direct fixation section. The rail actually gets pushed. If you could like a piece of yarn, if you were to push it, even though it's steel, it actually gets pushed along those areas. So we've kind of identified those areas and put heat sensors on, because if rail temperature goes up, it goes beyond the neutral temperature and starts to buckle, so we have those on there. And also track circuits themselves. Track circuits are not just to be able to provide information for train speed. Track circuits also provide provide broken rail protection. That's actually the primary component of a track circuit, is to be able to provide broken rail protection and train detection. They're both, it's common primary. So that technology is there.
I see that, but the fasteners, with respect to fasteners.
Currently, there is nothing technology-wise with fasteners.
Our next three members are all from the District of Columbia, and I understand that the district has a combined presentation or a combined list of questions for you gentlemen, so I will cede the authority to Mr. Evans and Stormjo and Mr. Bulger to decide how they want to proceed with a couple questions.
Well, I'll just say that we've worked really hard on the committee's draft board resolution, so when we get to that, I'll just stop here, Mr. Chairman, and proceed with Mr. Evans.
Okay, I'll try to go through these as quickly as possible. The first one Corbett asked, how many derailments have we had in the last 4 years and how do we compare to our peers? Although the answer was a little muddled. So maybe you just could get back to us when you look into that, okay? Was there any damage to the structure of the tunnel itself?
No.
Sorry?
No.
Okay. Were the rail cars damaged? Are they back in service? And how much, if they were damaged, how much did they cost to repair?
The rail cars were damaged. Not all of them are back in service. The costs are being, or we'll get back to you on that.
Okay. Could you please
and the damage was limited to the trucks. It was relatively minimal damage on the cars.
Minimal damage,
yes.
On the cars. Okay. Are they back in service?
Not all of them, no.
Some of them are.
Some of them, yes.
How many were damaged?
All but four. Four.
Four were damaged.
Yes.
So four of an 8-car train.
Four of a 6-car train.
Four of a 6-car
yes.
train.
Yeah.
Okay. So two are in service, four are not, and they're being repaired.
Specifically, that we have some back in service. I'll get back to you.
Okay. And if some of these questions have already been asked, just we'll move right on them. Please explain why a wide gauge is acceptable in certain locations on the track and why it is unacceptable on other sections.
There's limits to the acceptability of a wide gauge, where you can either have a yellow, which means a yellow defect, which we start to set parameters on these, where we say, okay, we need to get out and pay attention to that. A wide gauge on a red level defect would be where we have a speed restriction on that, and then a level black defect is we don't want to go any, because now we are risking potential to be able to put a train on the ground should we continue operations in those.
Okay. Why did the 10 rail fasteners fail?
That's under investigation. That'll be part of safety's investigation.
How many miles of track are currently secured by fasteners that are beyond their useful life?
I will have to get back to you on that specific information.
Okay. WMATA is proposing to beef up track walker inspections as part of its efforts to prevent future derailments. However, in their June 2015 report, the FTA found that WMATA has cut needed resources for track walkers by half. How does WMATA reconcile their proposed solution with the findings from the FTA?
Again, we did not cut our resources in half. We reallocated those resources to the way that the FRA standards are for that. I think what's important to recognize is, again, it's the quality of the track inspection. What are we looking at? What are we asking the track inspector to do in that specific instance? We did not cut the resources in half on those. We reallocated those resources, and we are looking right now. We are looking at resource loading on those to be able to identify those. But again, it's the type of track inspection. What do we have to do? How do we have to look at it? How much information do we require of the walking track inspectors?
All right, but, and just my follow-up is, if you're saying you didn't cut them in half, why does the FTA saying that you
did? We disputed that with the FTA.
Okay. Okay, how many track walkers does WMATA currently employ, and how has this changed over the past decade?
I'll have to get back to you on the specific numbers.
Okay. I've gone through 8 of the 12, so move on and I can come back to me.
I think that would be good.
If you guys have any follow-ups,
just
quickly.
Skip the order. Oh. Storm Joe.
First, I have two requests. I think that it was good that we published the investigation report as quickly as we did, and I think that we need to continue to be more transparent and forthcoming about what's going on at WMATA, even if it's troubling news. So I asked the team, and I'd like to know by the next committee meeting next week, to identify more pieces of information that we will, on a regular basis, disclose to the public. My colleague asked a lot of questions that I think are factual in nature, and I think on an ongoing basis, the press and the public and elected leadership in this region should have more access to information about WMATA, whether that's information about derailments, rail conditions, TGV results, track walker schedules. I think we have an organization that needs to improve its health, and sunlight is the best disinfectant. So I think we need to consciously make more information available to the public and the press. And if we as a board or you as management can't answer the questions of the press, then we'll know who's at fault. So that's one suggestion. Actually, it's a demand. The second is that I'm very concerned that WMATA doesn't know what it doesn't know, and isn't open to outside review and outside benchmarking and the introduction of best practices. I'm very troubled that we may have another incident where we suffer from this bunker mentality. So in my own experience within the district, trying to turn around somewhat troubled agency and dealing with very complex transit issues related to rail, it didn't take me very long after the streetcar caught fire to bring in outside people and to get APTA engaged and to get new people and new eyes on my system, albeit much smaller than WMATA. I really would like to see from WMATA's management team some sort of a demonstrated effort and commitment to getting fresh eyes on the problems with the organization, because I think we're having a lot of trouble here in terms of getting bad news up the chain, identified early and corrected, and whether that's defensiveness or overconfidence or passivity, I don't know. I don't really care. But I do think that there's a benefit to getting some outside eyes here to help us understand what we need to do to right the ship. So those are two things that are more statements than questions, but I'd like a commitment from Jack Recua that you will actually follow up on those two things.
We'll do that. I do want to mention, as Rob has mentioned, he has brought an outside expert in regards to derailment to assist in the investigation and to give us any input into processes or procedures that we need to do differently. I think just the fact that 4 or 5 years ago, the idea of bringing the TGV in as an additional tool, I think we're one of only two public transit systems in the country that has such a vehicle. I think the intent of that vehicle was to give us technical eyes on a system that we could not get from track walkers and other experiences. But again, we're open to, I think we're very open to any outside resources or outside eyes to assist us in improving the system. It's getting older, it's getting a lot of use, and, again, we're open, Rob's open, safety's open to processes that will make us even safer. And so we support everything you say, but I think that we are taking actions to try to implement that. Maybe okay. We need to do more.
Okay, I appreciate that. But I would also submit that this incident didn't occur on August 6th. It occurred on the day that you brought in the TGV. Because on the day you brought in the TGV, you did not have a process in place to avoid a hair trigger deletion of a real anomaly. And on the day you brought in the TGV, you did not have a redundant check built into the process. So this incident did not occur on August 6th of this year. It occurred the day you guys brought in the TGV. So I'd like to know how you had a process that allowed for those two things, and who signed off on that process? Was it the GM? Was it you, Rob? Did the safety department sign off on that process?
The process was internal into the track group.
Who signed off on the process? Is there an individual within the organization that signed off on the process that had those two fatal flaws built into it day one? Not August 6th, day one. Who signed off on that? Is there a document with someone's signature that signed off on that process? Yes or no?
I do not believe so.
Okay, that's a problem. So where does the buck stop? You guys talked about resignations of frontline employees. And you don't need to get into the specifics of that. But did the frontline employees do anything wrong?
Mr. Jormjo, I take full accountability for the incident.
Okay. So the frontline employees did not resign because they were destroying evidence or because they had unethical behavior or they were being uncooperative. They resigned for their own personal reasons.
I would prefer not to speak on their resignations again because it is a personal issue.
But you're not you just took responsibility.
I'm accountable. I am accountable for everything that happens under rail.
Okay.
I'm absolutely accountable for everything that happens under rail.
Okay.
And
why then are you participating in the investigation that Mr. Doherty is performing?
So
it gives me great concern that that isn't an independent investigation. Why are you attending the committee meetings that he just described earlier?
So I can assure that he's getting the full cooperation from the personnel and the people that are involved in it.
That's troubling. I'm very concerned that Mr. Doherty's office is a paper tiger in this organization. Mr. Doherty, can you help me disabuse me of that notion? Because when I asked several questions of you a couple months ago, you gave me answers that seemed to indicate that you had no problem giving stop work orders or suspension of service orders to these two gentlemen, but it seems to me that by your own testimony here today, you've got next to no information about what goes on at WMATA operationally. You say you fly at a high level. You don't even look at the SOPs. So what's the point of having the safety department if you're not deeply embedded in the organization's operations?
We may not look at the SOPs. We look at the higher level policies and the change that goes on in the organization and the training manuals.
Okay, I don't need to hear your response.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just want to align myself with Mr. Dermer's analysis of what the problem is, that the problem originated not on August 6th, not on July 9th, but back with the implementing and bringing the TGV into service and the failure to really thoroughly address how the TGV was going to work and what kind of redundant systems and safety critical systems were going to be in place to make sure that that system worked effectively and acted as a partner with our track walkers in finding defects. But that's an issue that we'll address as a committee and as a board further on down the line. I just want to go out of sequence for a minute and ask Ms. Hines if she has any questions, since she has another commitment. They have to leave. Mm-hmm. Normal time would come in this sequence of questions.
I appreciate that, Mr. Goldman. This is a special meeting, and I made a commitment many months ago that I have to leave here at a quarter to 12 to get to. I too wanted to talk about the TGV. I think one of the factors that hasn't been clearly stated is that this is a relatively new piece of equipment. I've been on the board 5 years. I remember when we brought this piece of equipment. I remember why we did it, which was we really wanted to get ahead of information about weaknesses in rails that would help us avoid broken rails. I think the TGV has, in fact, helped us to do that. But I do think that it points out, perhaps in less strong ways than some of my colleagues have used, that the issue of how WMATA brings a new piece of equipment in to its stable of tools and who looks at what I'm sure is the manufacturer's suggested process and asks the question of whether it is sufficient for WMATA, given the complexity of our system, certainly wasn't clear to me until we had this recent conversation. So, Mr. Troop, I just want to make sure that I understood the answers that you gave. You basically said it was within the track group. That's who looked at it. The initial thought was the track walkers were going to be the redundancy in the system. They were going to walk. They were going to, and for whatever reason, this all didn't work in this particular instance. And so while we can work to assign blame and while we can do these other things, my interest for this agency is what are we doing moving forward, and how are we going to, as a board, have assurance that if we bring a new piece of equipment, because I think that's part of what this issue is all about, is a new piece of equipment where the right eyes didn't look for redundancies and the right set of people didn't say, do we have, as Keturah said, people as well as machines examining this together. So I want to know from you guys, what is the plan moving forward to make sure when we do something new that we are building redundancy into our plan, into our review, into making, all of this is about keeping our, you know, million riders safe on our rails, keeping our employees safe. So how are we going to change our culture, our behaviors to ensure that we're doing that?
I'd like to answer a portion of that first. I think the first thing, everything you said is correct. We brought a new piece of equipment in here that was more than normal for a transit agency for the purpose of doing everything that we wanted it to do. We did not. We admitted that there was human error, and we admit that there were process errors. Rob has addressed at least a portion of the process error in an attempt to recertify the information at the end of the day, at the end of the run of the TGV vehicle, to try to correct any errors that are made during the run. Again, the process on this event will continue, and once the investigation is complete, there may be, or during the investigation, there may be other process changes that we need to make. And we've just got to reassure ourselves going forward that we, and I think that this is a terrible example of what happens, that we have to assure that we have redundancy in our policies, our procedures, our reviews, and that's the process that we're going through at this time. But I'll let Rob answer further.
Rob, just let me, if I might. So, Jack, right, we had this incident. We're learning from this incident. What I'm looking for is the new standard operating procedure that the agency is going to have when we bring in something new to make sure we don't set ourselves up for some other event like this. How?
To be able to go out and actually look at track structure, be able to identify that, look at ATC structure, be able to look at power structure, to be able to say, okay, you're not doing this right, and it is not to standards. So I welcome that oversight, and part of that is developing internally, since it doesn't exist from the federal agency side to that extent, to develop those processes internally that can emulate that type of federal oversight until the FTA and Metro Safety Committee can be provided more robust to be able to do that, to be able to provide that internal oversight. And also part of it at also bringing in outside experts, again, with the derailment expert, you know, that we're looking at, bringing the APTA peer review for the RCC, being able to look at that. Appreciated the FTA oversight coming in and doing the safety management inspection to be able to identify those gaps that we have in there. So the process is in place with the safety and security certification. Question is, what do we need to add to that process to be able to do that? And I think that that's where it would be most beneficial to us, in addition to creating those internal processes to emulate the FRA, which probably 6 months ago, and thank you to the board, I increased the quality control group to be able to, we do now within our vehicle engineering, to be able to do that within our track engineering, and then to be able to do that within our our track structures, and be able to do that within our ATC group. So all those steps are important on that. But first and foremost, what you know, where you're getting to is, where are those gaps now? I want to know where those gaps are now to be able to identify those and take care of those.
Well, you and all the rest of us, yes, too. Mr. Goldman, I'm not going to be here for the discussion of the resolution. Let me just say that I think figuring out an appropriate way for the board, and particularly our local technical staff, to understand this gap analysis is also going to be important moving forward. Too often in the years I've been here, we have incidents, we make a lot of change, and we don't figure out how we're going to monitor it moving forward. And I think we do a flurry, and then we subside, and we need to find a way on some of these really critical things to keep the key information regularly coming. And I don't mean every month, because that'll kill us all, but on some ordinary path. We have had those safety reports. We're now at a level of detail that I think is different from where we have been, and I think we need to figure that out. And finally, my last question before I have to leave is, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about replacing ties and fasteners. I mean, it's been one of the most constant conversations since I've been on the board. We've spent a lot of money to do that. I was interested today to learn more about the wear and tear on different parts of our railroad as a result. But I do hope that before we get back to the CIP conversation, that you will bring to us some thinking about, we really had thought we were reaching a stasis point on ties and fasteners, where we could kind of predictably know how much we were going to be spending every year. And I think particularly in this area, it would be useful to know if we really are approaching that stasis point, or whether this new information changes what we've all been sort of looking forward to in this particular part of taking care of the railroad. Thank you for letting me go out of turn.
Thank you. Mayor and Chair Downey, as well as the Associate Secretary as well.
All right.
I'm going to try to be brief because a lot of what I wanted to say has already been said, but I will preface my comments by simply saying that first and foremost, I think the ridership need to respect the fact and appreciate the fact that we indeed have a safe system. Yes, we've had some incidents that that has befallen us, but it is a safe system, and we want the riding public to know that we're committed to doing everything 24/7 to ensure that it continues to be a safe system. But as we talk about fasteners and tracks and everything else, let's not lose sight of the fact that we're also an aging and an old system. And in terms of our infrastructure, and we know that we need dedicated funding to keep this system running operationally, but also in terms of our capital improvement needs. However, certainly this most recent incident is troublesome. I'm not going to repeat a lot of what's already been said because I think my colleagues here on the board have raised some very good concerns and questions, and certainly hopefully staff will be responsive to us in the near future. I am troubled a little bit by the fact that knowing that this meeting was going to take place today, there's certain information that would have come as normal course of the business to be prepared for, to provide, to have ready answers. But we'll deal with that later. I'm going to actually shorten my comments by simply saying that I think at a subsequent safety committee meeting, we need to really get into the details of a lot more Q&A. And so what I wanted to, my questions today center around, again, the role of the safety director and who does that office or position report to, and if it doesn't report directly to the GM, maybe that's a change or something that needs to occur, but also concerned about the staffing level in the safety director's office. I'm in the construction business, and you know, as a general contractor or subcontractor, you have a safety director. You have your manpower on site trained in safety, but still, there's someone called OSHA that comes by and checks things. And you know, I'm not, I don't know whether we have a similar process here, but I thought what I heard troubled me that our safety folks don't really go out and look for things. And that's not how should business be done. And these local safety committees, great to have them, but again, I think there needs to be a lot more engagement and hands-on involvement with these safety committees. Obviously, what happened is human error, but we have human error throughout the whole system. It's not just on this, the track side, the rail side, the bus side. It's in the accounting department. It's everywhere. And we need to, that is something that system-wide, many of you have heard me say this time and time again, that we need to really get our hands around, because when you got 12,000 or more employees in the workforce, human error is going to occur. But we, you know, but we still need to have some process in place to minimize those errors and be responsive in a timely manner. And the redundancy certainly is something that we need to make sure is always in place. The process changes that have been offered up since the incident are valuable and important and reasonable, but I still question why, as much some of my colleagues already have stated or indicated, why they weren't in place prior to the incident. And then when we get, Mr. Troop, you've talked about it's really all about quality of track inspections, and I'm not going to disagree with you there, but I also think that in terms of the quality of track inspections, it gets to the personnel in terms of, you know, how many teams, I mean, first of all, what's the manpower level for track inspectors, and then how many teams do we have, and are they mentally fatigued, are they overworked, exhausted, or whatever? But again, these are the type of questions I think we'll want to explore when we have subsequent safety committee meetings. But I will just summarize by simply saying that, again, this incident appears to point out WMATA's previous procedures for checking tracks were lax and inadequate, and there's no way we can hide that.
Chair Downey.
Thank you. I certainly agree with my colleagues on a number of themes that are being established here: redundancy, transparency, accountability. We've got to up our game on all of those. Two areas that I'm particularly troubled by, one is
the role of the safety department. That was a firm action taken by the board 5 years ago, responding to Fort Totten and to our lack of understanding of what was going on in the ATC system as it had emerged, as it had been changed, as new equipment had been brought in. And it's my firm recollection that the intent was when major changes in process, in equipment, in supplies are brought into the system, that they should be reviewed from a safety standpoint and from a redundancy standpoint, and that we certainly continue to accept the idea that the safety director does report to the general manager and has to have equal authority. That was a severe criticism of where we were before, and it's not something we should slip back into. So we need to be sure that the safety department can speak up and can be looking at the things that need to be looked at. All SOPs probably need a review for redundancy, but certainly when change is made, and I would point out that bringing in a TGV to do the inspection is a pretty major change and an important change and a useful change in the way we're doing our business, but we did not follow through on how that should be used, and that's a mistake we shouldn't make again. My other concern is what's going on the system today. And recognizing a lot of work needs to be done, and we are doing it, and that's well and good, but I hope we are learning from that. As we've had this complete run of the system by the TGV, as we have gone out and made repairs, clearly more was wrong in the system than our process was bringing to our attention. Those areas that have been identified where work has been done, I would certainly expect we're going to go back and look at the track inspections that were undertaken, the TGV runs that were undertaken, and this is, since nothing was destroyed in any of these cases, we should be able to get a better handle on whether our processes do what they need to do. We can't just accept the idea that this was a one-off, unusual occurrence. What I'm sensing is it's much more usual than it should be. We have to do a better job of taking the resources we have in terms of the eyes of inspectors and the equipment of the TGV to identify the priorities. When FTA in its review came back to us and said there was a backlog of track work that had not been addressed, the answer was that was not the most significant, most important track work. It was work that would be scheduled, but I get the sense now that there were more things wrong that were not on our schedule, and I'd like to know fairly soon what you've found from the work that's now going on and what it tells us about the quality of our management of the program.
Again, what we're finding is, and this is where the TGV becomes very invaluable for us, is what we're finding commonality in the tight radius curves with some of the wear. And what that allows us to do is be able to prioritize much better where we need to put resources to be able to do that, not just in the prioritization of doing the work elements, but also in the prioritization of doing the inspections to be able to, you know, straight and level tangent track doesn't require as much visual inspection as curve track. You know, we know that, and we know that we have these instances there, so that we can do it. The other thing is again, what's very important is was it also identified in the FTA SMI, which is the alarms that go into the RACC. This is very analogous to the alarms that go into the RACC. If you have 10,000 alarms that go into the RACC and only three of them are really critical alarms, you know, you have that many that, you know, need to be partitioned out somewhere else. The way that we look at defects is, again, if you have a wheel burn, it's not a defect. You know, it's not a defect, but we mark it as a defect. So what it creates is some noise around what the prioritization of what needs to be done is. And I do research into this, and one of the things is that, you know, we're looking very carefully at is it good to prioritize, or the categorization of defect is critical. If we need to fix something, we need to fix something now. We need to fix it correctly. One of the reasons that we are taking a little bit more time to do some of the work that we're doing out there is because I'm getting rid of the gauge rod mentality. You know, we have gauge rods out there, which are necessary. They're important to be able to return. There's nothing wrong with them. They're a semi-permanent fix. You can leave them on there for you know, an extended period of time, and it's you know, it's not an unsafe condition, but it's not the correct fix. So what we have done is we have started to. I'm sorry, gauge. So a gauge rod. Can I go to the board? Not a permanent fix. It's not intended to be a permanent fix. You can have gauge rods out there for a long period of time without ill effect, but it's not a permanent fix. So what we need to do is get rid of this. You know, if we seldom put that out there on the big roads, on the FRA railroads. We would seldom put on the main line. We would seldom put gauge rods out. And if we did, we would get rid of them that night. And part of what we're doing is we're saying, okay, we have gauge rods out there, so we've initiated a campaign to get rid of all of those, to go back to where we're saying, okay, if a gauge rod goes out, it gets taken care of right away. So to your point about the categorization of defects, how we look at it, how we look at the broad-based thing, is we're getting back to the better practices, and Andy Off likes to talk about the blocking and tackling, the basics of what we have to do, of what we have to be able to do. We have to be in large production scale work. You know, it's necessary to be able to catch up with the backlog that we have to be in this large scale, but we can't forget that we have to do the standard maintenance practices that we have to do. Some of the work that we're doing out there before, we would have simply put gauge rods on. It's acceptable, but I've said, no, you know what we're going to do? We're going to defect the repairs right, and so we're moving towards that end. And again, a whole campaign to get those gauge rods off of there. So that's some of the processes that we're doing to improve overall how we do the maintenance and the prioritization of the work. So you know, we replaced 27,000 fasteners last year. I believe I have that number correct. And you know, it's important that we replace 27,000 of the right fasteners. You know, and we certainly think that we are there, but that's the kind of data that absolutely you've asked for and we need to address.
Further questions? Sergeant?
Thank you. I guess I will say thank you to my colleagues. I appreciate the questioning, and I think quite a bit of information has been brought out. I think one piece that I'd like to focus on, and I'll do it briefly because I think much what has been said is needed. I'll go back to the point that when we brought the TGV here, we talked about the importance of it and how important role it would play. And unfortunately, I think what we have missed here is that it was really the basic operational piece that was missed. That is, I think you had noted in one other report to us that these machines exist in a couple of other areas, but there are no specific guidelines. That is, it's for the particular railroad that you must design how you're going to work with it. And I think that's really the backbone to what has happened here. And unfortunately, I think it's a part of an overall system, whether it's a TGV or a TFR or anything else you bring in. There are certain basic functions that you do in every system to ensure that it's done right. And that was the failure. And that is disconcerting in that I think those are some of the things that we and Metro have tried to concentrate on most importantly. And I think as Mr. Yule has indicated, if it fails here in an operational role such as the track work, it will fail in any other type of environment. And that's the part that I think is really important to me to emphasize. I think that, Mr. Troop, you've talked about all of the things you have under your control that you want to see occur. But I think some of the things that we really have to look at are the basic things that would happen. How do you implement something on the most basic level and it get elevated with other the sophisticated tools or needs that exist here? And that's really the part that I'm concerned and would like to see. This investigation is continuing, and I think as we come back, if we can understand in setting where we're going to go from here, what are those other things that you've discovered that really need to have a greater sense of redundancy, if that's what we're going to continue calling it, but the basic operations are done with better certainty for success, and that's the one that I really would like to see.
All right, we'll begin a second round of questions, and hopefully shorter than the first. Let me begin with a couple questions to follow up on Ms. Tregoning's questions about the track walkers. I just want to be clear, Mr. Troop, should the track walkers have been able to identify both the wide gauge condition defect as well as the broken fasteners on the high rail at the point of derailment?
Again, as we go through the safety analysis, that's one of the larger questions that's being asked by the safety and the TOC report. The wide gauge issue, we are not entirely sure whether that would have been detected by the track walkers because of the lateral loading issue. A track walker could put a gauge down or a measurement and have a gauge within tolerance because the lateral loading would not have indicated that. The broken rail fastener, certainly if a fastener is missing, it's the type of stuff that the track walker needs to be able to identify, talk about, being able to look at the marks on the rail to be able to identify that perhaps there was movement on the track in this lateral load testing. That is something that I would hope that they would be able to identify. As we go through the records, for this specific determination, we'll make sure that, you know, we'll see in that regard for the track walkers. But again, more importantly to that, and I don't want to diminish the question. I understand what the question is and where it goes. But more importantly to that is what the expectation of our track inspectors is. The information that we're not only that we're asking them not to just report defects. You know, they can walk through and say no defects found. The quality of that report, but it's also the quality of what they looked at. Being able to identify the information that they looked at, how they looked at it, did they hit it with the hammer, did they look at the marks, did they note any marks on this type of thing moving forward. So I think it's premature for me to make judgments specifically on this incident right now as to what the track walkers could or could not have identified. But regardless of that, looking at the track inspection reports, it was concerning to me that the track inspections reports were done. They were done, I believe, in accordance. Right now, I believe they're in accordance with what the expectations were on that. And it's a matter of raising those expectations up so that we can provide a more complete picture moving forward. Again, it becomes much more critical the more rail cars we run through the system. These types of inspections become much more critical to not only identify the defects, but what the railroad is doing.
Prior to the purchase of the TGV and its implementation, what was the protocol for detecting wide gauge conditions on the track?
We had the walking track inspections. In addition, we had a third-party contractor would come in and do it. We had the lateral load testing, which we still use a third-party contractor to be able to do the lateral load testing. Holland comes in. They have a unit. The contractor is Holland. They come in and they actually apply, I believe it's 3,000 pounds of force. They apply 3,000 pounds of force against the rail. To make determinations, lateral loading against the rail to make determinations on wide gauge. So we had a third-party contractor come in and do ultrasonic testing, geometry testing, and we had the Holland unit to be able to come in and do lateral load testing. We still utilize the Holland unit to come in and do the lateral load testing. What we have found is as we benchmark the TGV against the Holland unit, we find that the TGV emulates that sort of that lateral loading because it does have weight to it. But it does not mean that we're going to, we still want to be engaged with the Holland unit as well.
As of today, have you determined how many times the track walkers inspected that section of track at the point of derailment between July 9th and August 6th?
Yeah, and it was in accordance with the July 9th and August 6th. So it was in accordance. We had track inspection reports in accordance with the standards, which is at least twice a week.
The standard is twice a week, so that would have been 4 weeks. Eight times somebody should have walked past that section of track. Okay. I want to just shift and ask Mr. Dougherty a couple questions. Mr. Dougherty, after August 6th, I understand that the TOC conducted a track inspection of itself in the area of derailment. Is that correct?
The TOC and WMATA, we conducted a site walkthrough on August 21st.
Okay, on August 21st. And you were present as part of that?
I was.
Inspection? Do you have a recollection of what observations the TOC representatives saw at the track at that point, or what you saw?
We were jointly with a track team that was out with us, and they were actually looking for defects. So we had seen some of the components that had been left possibly from replacement from the derailment. There was concern that some of the identification of defects, you know, were being noted. However, then when we followed up, as we were not using track gauges, that there were no significant defects or level black defects at that time, and they were also making repairs to the defects following our walk through the site. In other words, we actually left the site, they remained on the site, they made corrections throughout that afternoon, and then again back in that evening with the defects. But we were assured by the track inspectors that we're actually measuring the gauge, that the track was within a serviceable gauge limit.
Besides the gauge limit on the track, my understanding is that the TOC representatives and you observed track hardware that was missing bolts, fastener clips, and nuts, bent bolts still present, smashed rail plates. Is that accurate or not?
We saw some bent bolts, as you had mentioned. But within a time, the track was still serviceable. We're with a track engineer that actually was following along, you know, side of us as we looked at these things, and were assured that we were within a serviceable condition. Yes, we saw some track plates that we were told had been left from the work that had been done, from, as Mr. Troop mentioned, with a lower rail replacement, that some of the hardware hadn't been picked up as a result of that. We did see track gauges. We did see a couple of loose track gauges that were there on the site that they were looking to see if they needed, they would be tightened up or removed depending on the repair being made. So we didn't see anything or couldn't confirm that there was an actual issue that would have required the track to have been taken out of service at that time. But yes, we did see bolts. We saw some bent bolts that were there on the fasteners, you know, but they were still fastened. We did find too that the studs were actually broken at that point in time. However, the remaining fasteners, bolts, and studs allowed for the system to remain in service at that point in that curve.
And having seen that, did you generate a work order for those things to be corrected, for those defects to be repaired?
The work orders, I didn't generate the work orders specifically. The work orders were generated by the crew that was there in their Maximo system, and then we followed up to see that the repairs were made from that system, that were made that evening in the next couple of days over the weekend.
That would be in the period of August 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 2 weeks after the derailment on August 6th.
Yes, sir.
And your understanding is those conditions have now been corrected?
Yes, sir, and we're going to be making an inspection of that. You know, since that change, we'll be making an inspection.
But you haven't made an inspection yet since those changes were made?
Not by the safety, by the track crew, the inspection has been made, and we're going out to verify, you know, with a track crew, that those inspections have been, that the repairs have been made satisfactorily.
Is the fact that there were some gauge rods there at that point of derailment on the track, what does that suggest to you?
Gauge rods, as Mr. Troopit said, bring the track back into a serviceable condition by tightening up on that track. So the gauge rods, and we've actually been back, there's not a standard on a number of gauge rods that we've looked at, as well as other TOC members have looked at, to find if there is any standard that says thou shall only allow 10 gray gauge rods in 30 feet or something like that. There is not a standard. In track gauge rods, depending on the system, are allowed to be used until a more permanent repair can be made. And there's no specific time of what a temporary repair is, whether it's 24 hours or 24 days.
Well, that's what I'm trying to understand. Are we living with this temporary repair right now of gauge rods that bring the tracks within the metro system tolerance of 56.25 inches? Or has a permanent repair now been made such that the fasteners have been fixed and the gauge rods are no longer needed to maintain the proper tolerance on the track?
That I'll have to let you know based on our verification, our inspection we'll be doing today.
Yeah, could you find that out and let us, all the board members, know whether we're still dealing with temporary repairs or whether a permanent repair has been made?
Certainly.
Thanks. I have a few more questions, but we'll go around and see if others do as well. Ms. Harley?
Rob, you had stated that to date 27,000 of the fasteners have been replaced. Can you give a estimation and percentage how much of the system that is?
We replaced 27,000 fasteners last year. Andy, do you know the number offhand?
There were 550,000 in the system, excluding 10.
Okay.
And those were fasteners that were done last year.
Okay. Not. And will the board receive a report from the third party review for this incident?
Yes, yeah, it'll be part of the, yes. Yeah,
okay.
Certainly.
So this is just a follow-up to Mr. Goldman's question to Mr. Dougherty. Is it normal for a safety officer doing an inspection in a train system to not utilize materials to measure safety in a train system?
Normally, but my experience has been in the safety departments throughout the country, the instrumentation is used after an event or a derailment at that point in time. As Mr. Troop has mentioned, you know, for an FRA inspector, they go through and use the equipment, or my experience with the regulatory bodies has been that they have the staff put the equipment down, lay the equipment, and then they verify the reading of that equipment or what they're seeing from that equipment, which is something that just as recent as yesterday, Mr. Reek and I discussed, you know, safety departments a greater role in doing that.
So as you're walking and inspecting an incident scene, you are literally just walking and viewing with your eyes an incident scene
and
as a safety officer.
You're looking at what the operations folks or the track walkers or the instrumentation that they're using whenever they're out doing the field, like on our on-site visit that we were doing. And they were actually using the, you know, checking the gauge of the track as we went, and we didn't see any out of limits gauge when we were out on the 21st, if that's what you're referring to.
So your job as a safety officer is literally just to review other people inspecting the track?
Typically, at this point, under what's known as system safety, we review the actions that is being taken and verify that the work is actually being done. And it's one of the things that we're looking at moving forward to be more in an inspection mode versus an auditing mode, if you will.
Okay.
Mr. Augustine? Mr. Price, you get a shot again.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all the technical information that's been departed thus far, but I have a fundamental issue in terms of the root cause and looking at a company and so forth. I'm looking at the role of the safety department in terms of examining, and from a preventive point of view, I view safety as life safety from a preventive point of view. And I have to say that since I've been on this board, I've sat through these elongated safety presentations with statistics and data, and I use a lot of that in my business. But I have absolutely no confidence in the safety department. I'm going to be very blunt about that. I have no confidence. Furthermore, rank and file employees are disciplined when their safety lapses. but yet the management gets a pass. We cannot continue to allow this behavior to go on. And I think we have to look at, and I would request that the general manager look at the safety department. I think we need fundamental change. I understand the operational issues, but I see safety department as a check and balance on the operations and so forth. And I don't see that taking place, and I have no confidence whatsoever. That's a statement, not a question. Thank you.
Mr. Goning.
I'm a little worried about the time, and I know we've spent a lot of time on this already. Is it at all appropriate for me to raise some of the other issues I mentioned about communications?
Yes, inappropriate. I think we should stick to the operational audit and finish that today. And the safety committee and this committee will meet again on September 25, a day after the Pope leaves our nation's capital. All of you out there, new time for the next meeting of the safety committee and the board, and I think that'll be the appropriate time to take up other issues.
The only thing I'll say about it is that, you know, we spent a lot of time fighting the last war in this organization. So we have an incident. We look with laser sharpness at what all the possible causes are, and the board is pretty demanding of the staff of the agency to get us answers as quickly as possible. But I'll just say, you know, I called in a suspicious package on Monday when I was on board a train. The transit police got there very quickly. I was really excited about that. But I had to actually, I had to make three attempts to call it in. The third attempt involved me stepping off the train that I was on because every time the train moved, I would lose the signal. I'd have to recall it in. They didn't get the critical information that they needed. And that for most of our passengers, you know, who experience incidents every day, who might see something suspicious, who might want to raise something, I mean, this is the way they communicate. And that I ask about this every other safety meeting probably, about the urgency I feel about getting the communications right. If anything happens, you know, our lifeline, the other incident had to do with the intercom system, but to me this is even more important. So I'll just say it again and hope we can address it at our next meeting.
Thank you.
May I address one point of that really quickly? Mr. Groening, thank you very much. And I share your urgency and be able to provide both the radio communications for the T-band and also the cellular service in there. We have prioritized the work on that project. The only project that has greater priority right now is the track circuit project. So, and again, we will be looking at means and methods to be able to accelerate that to the greatest degree we can, recognizing that it is very difficult working in the tunnels and it is very time consuming. But that is a priority for me. It's a priority for the organization to move forward on that. Thank you very much.
Ms. Bulger.
Mr. Chairman, if I could move the debate to the draft board resolution that we've all worked very hard on, including you and the chairman, and over the last couple weeks, that's in our packet. We could, as it's written, it's in draft form, to get the committee's input, as we've discussed. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if you want to move to the resolution at this point or continue going around.
I think what I'd like to do is leave the resolution out there. We've gone 2 hours already.
I know.
And I think we'll leave the next 2 weeks for our members of the committee to comment informally on what they see is in the draft resolution and what additional things they would like to see in the draft resolution or what they'd like taken out of the draft resolution. And since we will have a meeting September 25, we'll bring that all together, revise the draft resolution, and present it as a product for committee consideration on the 25th.
Well, I didn't know we were going to do that, but that sounds like a reasonable process. Okay.
I don't want to have a discussion that's sort of push to reach a conclusion before it plays out on 25th, and I want to give other people that aren't here today an opportunity to be here then.
Okay. Chair? The committee should make a recommendation in an appropriate fashion relating to the board's role and management's role, state what we believe should be done.
Yeah, and as you see in the draft, a couple areas I believe, as your chair, that our resolution should impart to the general manager is a sense of the board in the areas of dealing with other safety-sensitive areas that involve human input, something that a number of questions have dealt with today. A second area is the authority of the safety department and the chief safety officer to be doing more than apparently they've been doing in the past, and to be doing more going forward. And on the issue of discipline as to who's responsible and how those responsibilities should be dealt with by the general manager. That's not a function of the board to dispense discipline, but I think we, as a board, can provide the general manager with some policy direction as to where we would like to, what issues we would like to see him look at in that regard. So I'll just stop at that point and leave it to members to consider as we review this subject and revisit it on September 25. Ms. Hudgens.
The investigation, the investigation is not complete, is that correct?
I believe Mr. Dougherty said that he's now taken over the operational incident report, and he's preparing a report that will be presented to the TOC sometime by, I believe the date was October 4th.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct? Mayor, any questions? Mayor? Let me just raise one more question, just wrap up one area. The optical scan reports that the CGV operator prepares, I believe you've stated, Mr. Troop, that those are all downloaded into the Optram system. Is that correct? And those are all of the scans since the beginning of the use of the TGV vehicle, is that?
I'm sorry, repeat the question.
I think you stated that the TGV optical scan reports are all, the original report, before the exceptions, before any deletions, are downloaded into the Optram system, or there's some kind of maintenance?
Yeah, that's correct. All the raw data is downloaded into the Optram.
My question is, since that time, and I know it's the protocol now to have that reviewed after the fact by the area track maintenance, other people, but was there ever a review of that data, even on an ad hoc basis, before August 6th, by anybody in your department?
The Optram data is reviewed, but it's mostly reviewed. It was not at that time reviewed for sort of that specific information. What it was reviewed for was analytical information. What the Optram system does, it not only gets the the TGV data in there, it also takes into account the track inspections, being able to bring in other Maximo work orders that happen to be on the track, to be able to specifically for, to be able to check against what would have been an error that would be made, but more of an analytical aspect to be able to look at it and say, okay, we noticed that we were starting to get emerging wide gauge issues. Let's get in here and start doing testing on that. Again, that sense change. That'll be done within 2 days for that. That analytical work will still be done, but the report will be scrubbed within 2 days with an engineering group on that.
But prior to August 6th, there was no even ad hoc auditing of what was done in the exception reports.
That's correct, yes. Yes.
Mr. Dougherty, is that the same answer that you would give from the safety department, that your office never reviewed those reports?
No, sir, we didn't have the Optram reports.
I'm sorry?
No, you're correct. We did not have the Optram reports. So we didn't review them.
Do you have them now?
Yes, we're now getting them as part of this investigation, and we've requested a daily track condition report moving forward, which operations is working on and providing.
Besides the, for use in this investigation, do you get them now on an ongoing basis so you can audit what's being done?
We're supposed to be. We've gotten a couple, but we're working on getting that process in place to get them on a daily basis.
Thank you. Taken 2 hours for this committee meeting this morning. There's other business before the board today. Anybody else have any other questions today? If not, I call this meeting to an end until September 25.